24 hours a day, 7 days a week. On demand, powerful talk radio. We global, and you can do nothing about it. BashaniRadio.com. Always talking about everything. Keep it locked. Keep it locked. Keep it locked. Keep it
locked. Keep it locked. Keep it locked. This is David Spradley, and you should check out Z, the SEO queen.
Do you have an online business or want an online business but lack the team or the expertise to get on Google Page 1? Did you know that 33% of all Google search traffic clicks the first result only? Do you want to get more traffic to your website, social media profile, or just want your video to get more hits or go viral? Well, you need to contact the SEO Queen Digital Marketing Agency, where you are more than just a number. You can't lose with the SEO Queen. More visibility, more credibility, more profitability. Visit theseoqueen.net for more information. That's theseoqueen.net. theseoqueen.net. That's theseoqueen.net. That's theseoqueen.net.
Hello, this is Lady Z, the violinist. I'm coming to you because I want to encourage you to get your copy of Elevate. It's available on Apple Music and iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. So if you're listening to this on your computer or your cell phone, whether you have an Android or an iPhone, you can get your copy of this song, this show's theme song, by just going to Apple Music, Amazon, or Google Play and get it today. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
This is David Spradley, and you're listening to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z, a podcast about the secrets to success in technology, music, and business on Bashani Radio, iHeartRadio, and iTunes. Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. You can listen to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z on any mobile phone or tablet device. The Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z, where we explore tech and enjoy the music and learn the secrets to success in music, technology, and business. Please follow us online at www.ladyz.com and on all social networks at Lady Z. And please pull out your phones and follow me now at L-A-D-Y-Z-H-E. My next guest is, wow, just amazing. I'm just like, well, let me share a little bit about Chef Ashbel with you. Chef Ashbel McLean's cooking credentials range from working with Martha Stewart in Connecticut to cooking at the Serpentine Gallery in Hyde Park by Royal Commission of Princess Diana. I hope you guys heard that. He was commissioned personally by Princess Diana. How you doing? And to feeding 5,000 servicemen and women as a guest chef on the USS Kearsarge in Norfolk, Virginia. Chef Ashbel has been featured chef at the Bermuda Culinary Festival and the Mid-Atlantic Food and Wine Festival, among others. In 2002, Chef Ashbel made culinary history when he opened and helmed Ashbel's restaurant in Notting Hill, London. Ashbel's was the first African-American owned and operated restaurant in London and received a 4-star rating from the London Times by A.A. Gill. Now, A.A. Gill, who's now deceased, he was considered by many to be one of the, toughest food critic in the world. In stateside broadcast media, Chef Ashbel has also appeared as a regular food contributor to NBC's Weekend Today show, cooking alongside celebrities and introducing the diversity of New York City's ethnic fare to a hungry audience. He was also recently featured on the Food Network's hit show, Beat Bobby Flay, and on popular podcasts, The New York Times, Tell Me Something I Don't Know, and Top Rated Live from Prince Street. In the UK, Chef Ashbel was a regular featured contributor on the BBC Channel's 4 most popular daytime foods show, Good Food Live. And in 2016, this is incredible. This really touched my heart when I found out about the nonprofit, the James Hemings Society. Now, the James Hemings Society is very, very, very important, especially in the line of African-American history and just American history, period, because the James Hemings Society seeks to formalize the remembrance of Hemings' contribution to the American table. The foundation helps to document the African-American contribution to fine dining in America and creates a platform for the celebration, the education and celebration and nurturing of the next generation of diverse young people in the food industry. And I would be remiss if I didn't share with you guys about the Chef Ashbel being the founder of Ashbel.com, which, by the way, you can get turkey pastrami. Oh my God. Can you? I mean, turkey pastrami is just like, wow. So a few years ago, Chef Ashbel decided it was time to combine his knowledge of global flavor and spices with the love of smoked and cured meats. Ashbel's was born honoring the generation of masterful family cooks that came before him. His very modern take on their flavors and methods became a homage to his grandfather, Grandpa Ashbel, which is prominently featured in the branding of Ashbel's premium meat and seafood. Now, the quality seal is very personal, and it's awesome to see, you know, Grandpa Ashbel on every label. That's very important for us to see images of ourselves. Now, a portion of all sales of Ashbel's brand products goes to the James Hemings Foundation. You can learn more about the James Hemings Foundation by going online to jameshemingssociety.org, and you can learn more about Ashbel's by going to ashbel.com. But without further ado, I want to say hello. How are you, Chef Ashbel?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on.
Awesome. I just want to just get into it. Like, your career, you have opened a restaurant in London, in Notting Hill.
Yes.
You've been commissioned by Princess Diana herself. Wow.
Well, it was a commission from the Serpentine Gallery, which Princess Diana founded.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, and I was invited to be the chef at the cafe, which was inside a Toyo Edo piece of steel art in the origami style.
Wow.
And I had a cafe inside the pavilion. And it was called Ashbel's at the Serpentine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm very proud of that because it definitely gave me a big foot up and introduced me to London.
Wow. Yeah.
So I'm just very happy about that. Very pleased that that is, you know, one of the achievements. It was very personal to me and I totally enjoyed it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So your career, what caused you to be so interested in so many different flavors? What got you interested in culinary history? Because I have to confess, I believe you're the only culinary historian I know.
Well, there's a lot of them out there nowadays, okay? A lot of culinary historians, and particularly Black culinary historians. What really got me was I knew from my family, because I grew up in a family that thought good food was a birthright. And when the South was still segregated, and that's where I grew up, in the modern version of chattel slavery, Jim Crow. That's where I grew up. And I went to school segregated by law. So, you know, there weren't very many restaurants in the South at that time. So fine food, whenever you were a congressman, a senator, or a judge, or mayor, and you had an occasion, somebody Black, like my family members, made all of the food. And this wasn't, this not to be confused with the term soul food. What was served at those events was the finest of Southern regional cooking. A very different thing.
Now, what is the difference between Southern fine food and soul food? What is
Well, the finer foods, you have the choice of cuts of meat to work with. And so, you know, instead of having the ham hocks to deal with, you have the hams, which can be cured in a variety of ways. And that is something that African Americans excel at. And from colonial times, they're the ones that established fine food in America. It took chefs like James Hemings and Hercules Washington, who brought fine Virginia plantation cooking to Philadelphia. It was the first time that that kind of cooking came to an urban center. Before that, it was basically the English, Irish, Scottish tradition of food that it, that was in the colonies. Now, this same bit of food was in the Virginia too. It was the addition of the African that made an incredible change in the food and changed the food for the better. So that basic English, Irish, and Scottish cooking, when the Africans got a hold of it in Virginia, they said, oh, well, this is bland, but throw some of these weeds in there and then put some of these berries in and put some pepper. This has no flavor. And literally, the Africans put flavor in the food, enhanced the food to a point where it was worthy of a world-class cuisine and not just the cooking.
Right.
Because it had the depth and breadth of flavor. So that is the fine cooking that came to Philadelphia with Jefferson and Madison and all of the people trying to draft the Constitution. And as a matter of fact, Hercules Washington is famous for feeding the Congress at 6th and Market in Philadelphia every Wednesday. And he would serve four courses, but each course had up to 9 dishes in it.
And four courses with 9 dishes in each course?
Yep.
Wow. Yep.
It would be up to 9 dishes in each course. And he did it all out of a fireplace. And his...
Out of a fireplace?
Absolutely.
And how many people did he serve at once?
Well, it was the whole Congress at the time. So it had to be at least 30, 35 people.
Wow.
And he literally, still enslaved, you know, he had, he staffed the kitchen and he ran it like a general. He dressed in impeccable white. And what he was able to do after the dinners were over, he would dress up impeccably in this red broadcloth coat and impeccably white leggings and shirt. And he'd walk down Market Street, selling the leftovers to the foodies of the time. He would sell what was called the slops. And
wow.
If you understand that at the time, whole animals came into the kitchen. So furs and the fats and all of that, the renderings from animals, when you process them, you take the hide off, the feathers and all of that. Mm-hmm. All of that was considered the slops. And so he had a very comfortable life.
So he would sell that? Would he keep the money from that?
Yes.
Or would he have to give it?
He was able to keep the money from the slops. So he was not, he was not poor in that respect. And you follow the story of him working with George Washington. It was actually money that was supposedly stolen by Hercules' son, which made George Washington take him out of the kitchen and put him back in Virginia at Mount Vernon on hard labor busting rocks.
Oh, wow.
So it just showed you the power of the white establishment over the lives of African-American people.
Mm-hmm.
And what Hercules did was literally disappeared. He ran away on George Washington's 60th birthday, I think. And he never, never, ever was heard from again. Until recently, there were some discoveries in the past, like 2 or 3 years, where he actually settled in New York City, and he didn't cook again because Washington was looking for him everywhere. And as he was of Ona Judge, the woman who escaped to New Hampshire, a free state, and she agitated, and the state protected her because Washington couldn't get his hands on her, even though he wanted to. So it's funny that those two enslaved people actually successfully ran away from slavery from George Washington.
Wow.
And a lot of people don't know it. And, you know, and it's just that food that was brought by those enslaved chefs from Virginia was literally the finest food in America at the time.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's why I make the distinction between soul food and Southern regional cooking, which is a cuisine. It has the depth and breadth of flavor to stand up to any world cuisine. And so, you know, just we're getting credit for just what we made out of the offals, the throwaway parts.
Mm-hmm.
Something that we have done consistently, which is make do. And just making something out of nothing.
Right.
And that's our legacy in this country. And we took nothing, which was the Declaration of Independence and this country, because it didn't include us as
include us
as
human beings,
as citizens, or as humans.
Right.
And I remember giving a lecture at Monticello, and I said that to a crowd of about 100, and this little white lady in the front row, she said, "It didn't include me either," and she was absolutely right.
Right.
She was absolutely right. And so, you know, I embrace all of the mixtures of cultures that help to make American regional food fine food. And you know, and a good part of it goes to enslaved Irish women. There very little is said of the indentured servant.
Wow. Wow.
Very little is said about them. And, you know, for me, I like getting the full story. And it's good just to, you know, really understand what kind of contributions that James Hemings and Hercules Washington had on fine food in America. I just became so curious as to why this isn't common knowledge. You know, as many French fries as the average person eats every year.
Right. I mean,
without even knowing, or macaroni and cheese.
Right.
Or firm ice cream.
Right. I mean, those are pretty much staples of the American diet daily.
And it's so interesting that he did not invent these dishes. James Hemings trained at the Chateau Chantilly in Paris, which was the epicenter of 18th century cooking in Paris. It was so famous for the food. The food was considered better than the food that was served at Versailles. And that's where he trained. And the Chateau Chantilly had incredible villages around it that were only there just to supply the best ingredients and the best food for the chateau, which normally fed between 250 and 1,300 people three meals a day. And I've actually stood in the kitchen, which is still there, where James trained, on the potager stoves that he brought, whose technology he brought back to America. And I was completely unprepared for the information that I got when I went to Chateau Chantilly and spoke to the archivist. They wanted to know all about James Hemings. And
so you went to France to research him?
Yes. I had been a student in France when I was a junior. I spent my junior year abroad.
Okay. Okay.
In a program in France. So I speak French fluently.
Okay. Okay.
And I went to do this bit of research right where he was trained. And so when I'm sitting with the archivist, they said, well, who's James Hemings? And I said, he was enslaved to Thomas Jefferson. And they went berserk. They were like, oh, no. C'est pas possible. No, c'est pas possible. And they literally ran around and took out all of these archival letters which had banned slavery or any enslaved person from being, admitted into the chateau.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to slow this whole interview all the way down because there's a lot of questions that I have. And we're going to have to go play by play.
Okay.
All right. So you sitting in the archives, you're talking to the archivist, and then they flip out when you mention James Hemings and that he was a slave.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And then they run and get a bunch of different books, documents saying that France had no slaves. Is that what they're trying to say?
No, that the chateau had banned slaves from entering the chateau, or anybody who owned slaves from entering the chateau 20 years before James even got to the chateau to be trained.
So are you telling me that Thomas Jefferson lied about the nature of the relationship between him and James to get James in there?
He not only lied, he hired a lawyer to get around the fact, to give him legal advice.
Wait. Hold the freaking phone. Hold the phone, because I mean this is some juicy tea, some remarkable information. So you telling me a sitting president of the United States lied to another government?
Absolutely. And took legal advice to give him some legal advice of how to get around the fact that slavery was forbidden in France proper. There was still slavery on the French-controlled islands in the Caribbean. But in France itself, all an enslaved person had to do was to walk themselves into the Admiralty Court and declare their freedom. And when I got this piece of information, I always wondered why James Hemings, he could have declared his freedom at any time, and why he didn't. And then I understood it. What had been the whole situation at the Chateau anti-slavery, the whole movement in France at the time was vehemently anti-slavery. And Duchess, who was a cousin to the King of France, had discovered a young Black woman that was left in France by somebody that had brought her in from one of the French islands, and had left her in France. So she adopted the girl, paid and adopted legally in the church. They pulled out the baptismal certificate and the documents with, where it showed that this is why slavery wasn't allowed in this house. And I was surprised to see it, but I was more surprised to find out that James Hemings himself was hiding his status in America from anybody in France, because it would have ruined the reputation of Jefferson and Franklin and the other American delegation, because, you know, it was the French that provided the money. So during the Enlightenment, and Jefferson was a darling of the Enlightenment, he would have been a social pariah had James literally walked in and declared his freedom. He would have been cut off completely. The money that financed the Revolutionary War was French money, and that would have been cut off. And James Hemings, who, you know, read and spoke French fluently, learned how to write it fluently, and he could read and write English fluently. He was a very educated person, and he knew what the ramifications were, and he did not expose that delegation. And I believe he didn't do it because of his love of Virginia and his family in hope. And that's why he came back to the United States into slavery, in my opinion, was that he was in Europe for 5 years with this man, Jefferson, playing up to the anti-slavery movement and not once admitting that he had indeed brought two slaves into France, which, you know, literally James could have destroyed that, the whole U.S. delegation. And it was so important because it was money and the credit of the young United States was at stake. And he understood that. And so for me, he is literally one of our revolutionary founding fathers. And he literally followed in the footsteps of a lot of African Americans who put their hopes in powerful white folks. And Jefferson was never to deliver on those hopes, but he would benefit from weaponizing James's ability to cook incredible dinners. And it's a real sordid history. Well, this is the reason why I'm doing the documentary on James Hemings, Ghost in America's Kitchen.
You know, I just saw the documentary Birth of the Cool on Netflix with Miles Davis, and how he came back from France. He was in Paris, and he broke bread with Pablo Picasso and all these people. And you sharing this history makes things make more sense about these Black intellectuals and artists that went to Paris in various times throughout American history, and how they were treated and how they felt when they came back here.
I can remember.
Explains it all.
Yeah, well, I was a 19-year-old and went to France for my junior year abroad. And James was 19 when he went to France. And it was, you know, and I, he went from, you know, slavery in America, and I went from a segregated South, which was the newer version of chattel slavery. And I, you know, and I understand that the French are, you know, were not particular about, you know, who they're attracted to. They're just like, oh, you could be green, but come on, let's have a go. And it literally was that. That's a part of their psyche. It was that when I was there at 19 years old, and growing up in, you know, with the whole system of, you know, if a white girl comes up to you, you better just like, keep away. And I was shown quite differently. I was quite shocked because I had no defenses for white women coming up to you and actually treating you like everybody else, basically. And it was a bit of a learning curve for me. And the French being, you know, having very active libidos goes a long way back in hundreds of years back in their history. I believe that James Hemings, while he was in France, had a relationship with one of the royal duchesses.
Wait a second. He had a relationship with who?
With one of the royal duchesses. At the
Chateau, wow.
Where he was trained in the kitchen.
Wow.
And I'm excited because I'm now in talks with some other producers to do a whole episodic series of James Hemings' life. Because his achievement, both leaving America, getting that training, and then taking over Jefferson's, being chef at Jefferson's house on the Champs-Élysées, where he cooked for the most discerning palace in 18th century Paris and royalty. And it's just curious that James supervised a staff of 10 French-speaking kitchen workers, and while he was making history, you know, cooking at the first American diplomatic embassy.
So I have a question, and I know you probably get tired of being asked about Sally, but how in the heck did Thomas Jefferson play it off, his relationship with Sally in France?
She was well, right. That's a very complicated question because while everybody in France at the time was literally it was sexually fluid and sexually free at the time. In other words, everybody was doing it. And swinging.
Not like it is now where people aren't doing it as much as they like people to think they're doing it. They're really
absolutely. But this was free for all in a lot of ways. And it still kind of helped to shape the modern French kind of psyche about sex, which, you know, which allowed a prime minister to be elected while he had a girlfriend and a wife. And the girlfriend and the wife had public fights. But he still got elected prime minister of France.
What was this?
The guy before Macron. I can't call his name at the moment.
Wow.
But he was very famously had his wife and his girlfriend, they're both in politics.
Wow.
Well, you can imagine that that would not happen in America.
No, it would not.
No, but it you know, that's the kind of atmosphere that the French don't, you know, mix sex with politics necessarily. Mm-hmm. And you know, the stuff that we get all crazy about, oh, we looked at that girl and oh, we're disqualified for this and that. The French are not like that at all. And And it really shows so much weakness from Jefferson. No strength of character. And a real weakness. And you know, it's about time that somebody points out that Jefferson was just a consumer. He was just a consumer. He was inquisitive, and I give him that, but he literally kept even his children enslaved, his children by Sally enslaved, until the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it because he mortgaged their value to keep his lifestyle.
Wow.
Literally mortgaged his
kids'
property, and including his children with Sally, so that he could have the best wines and the best food.
You know, the thing that's so crazy, I think a few years ago, I think it was in the 90s, there's this mm-hmm. big story that was done on the Hemings family, and I just felt like this whole conversation between, you know, the black and the white side was mm-hmm. overly cordial. I think there's a lot of healing that needs to happen in that relationship instead of glossing over.
Well, they're doing
these facts.
Yeah. I think they're doing it. I've been lucky to, you know, meet some of the Hemings descendants. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be at Monticello when they were excavating the men's bathroom, which was the original 1790s kitchen, was under the men's bathroom for 50 years. And so I was there when the archaeologists had dug out the whole building and uncovered this 1790s kitchen that James put in. And I was blessed to be able to stand in front of the Portage stove where it had been on 1790s dirt
mm-hmm.
with charcoal still in the stove. And I literally was so changed by the situation that I understood that there were voices and of the people that had worked and toiled, and I had a bit of a comeuppance because those spirits of the people that had been there literally came to me and let me know, this isn't about Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
This is about us. And this is about what we did here. We did with pride and the best of our ability in spite of our circumstances.
Mm.
And I literally had a different view of Monticello because I had been railing because I saw a video of a white chef cooking one of James Hemings' dishes, snow eggs, in that Monticello kitchen. And I was railing because I was like, well, they weren't there before, so what is she doing there now? And that's when the spirit let me know that what they did there, they did with pride. And any chef in America worth any bit of salt should come and pay homage to that kitchen.
Yeah, that's the least that they can do is pay homage to the kitchen because they were not paid and compensated for their labor when they were alive. My biggest, you know, as a descendant of slaves on both sides of my family, myself, I'm particularly, you know, once I understood how, you know, trust work, life insurance and different things like that, I really understood the depth and breadth of the theft from my ancestors. And I agree with you. I think the least that people can do is pay homage to our ancestors and everything that they brought to the table for this country. That's the least that they can do.
Forget that it's his story that we were reading. His story.
Right.
Now it's just time for us to tell our story.
Right.
I was recently in South Carolina visiting my niece, and she knows I love pound cakes, so she had a pound cake made for me.
Mm-hmm.
I tasted the cake, and then immediately I knew, I was like, oh, this cake is like, it's delicious, it's old-fashioned. One bite, I knew it. So I said, well, give me the number of the woman who made the cake. So I, she did, and I called up the woman, and she was nice, and I said, I'd love to interview you or film you for some pieces I'm doing on Black culinary history. And she said, oh, no, my husband won't allow me to do that. I just make cakes for friends. It's not a real business or anything. I said, well, you learn how to make that cake from somebody. And I'm going to keep that. She said, oh, it's so nice of you, but no, I can't do it. I can't do it. I just can't possibly do that. And I got the phone, and I said to my niece, I said, is this the Black woman who's made the cake? And she said, no, it's a white woman. So I called her right back.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, I said, just because I'm looking for and researching my own culinary history doesn't mean that I'm negating yours. You are part of this story. You learned that cake from somewhere. And she said, I'd be happy to be a part of it. Nobody ever asked us like that. I said, I'm asking because it's a part of the story and I want to know the whole story. I just don't want to know, I feel good now. I can feel good because, you know, I recognize where the problems are. And No. You know, this is about American history.
Right.
And we didn't create it on our own. But what we did create, because of our agitation of being excluded, we did create, because of the agitation, that march from the Civil War all the way to, you know, the Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
It was the agitation of African Americans that literally brought democracy to America, that forced democracy on America.
Right.
And so many people don't understand that that's what we did.
Right.
That's what we
did. Because we fought against the poll taxes and they, I mean, you said a mouthful there because it affected less educated people.
Oh, absolutely. I literally went in 1960, my mother, to register my older sister to vote in the Kennedy election.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked about 2.5 miles from our house to the courthouse. And it was a $15 poll tax in Sumter, South Carolina at the time.
Wow.
My father made $20 a week.
Lord have mercy.
Okay.
Lord have mercy.
She saved that money and literally registered my oldest sister to vote. And I just saw her face and the pride on her face to say, yeah, well, at least somebody in my family going to vote.
Mm-hmm,
and we see the result of those strong women in
David
South
Spratt.
Carolina today.
And you're listening to
the
Jazz and Tech Lounge.
Those same strong women. And I've got to say that I was so blessed to have been brought up. You know, I was raised by women, not by wolves.
Mm-hmm,
and literally allowed to blossom and to mentor and be mentored by, you know, black teachers who were in South Carolina, were obligated to teach us South Carolina history. So I'll never forget my seventh grade South Carolina history teacher, Mr. Theodore Black. He started the class, he opened the book, the state book that had, you know, only references to black people were slaves and pickaninny. And that was a South Carolina state history book to be taught to every student. He opened the book and he said, every single test we have is going to be open book. So, but now let me tell you about what black people have done in this country. And he risked his job, his livelihood, to give us our story and to prepare us for anything that would happen in the world, anything. And that is, that's why I'm so grateful for the shoulders that I stand on, because
they
had real risk, you know, not the, oh, you know, did you believe they didn't want to wait on me? No, they had real risk of penalties of death. And still we thrive.
Right.
And I, you know, I'm just, you know, as I look back in the culinary history, all these other bits of African American character come up. And James Hemings, when Jefferson was appointed by the Congress president. He sent for James Hemings to come and be the chef at the White House. James refused unless Jefferson wrote him a letter like he would any free man. And he stood up to the strongest man, the most powerful man in his universe, and said, no, I'm not coming because you called me like you did when I was your slave. And now you must write me a letter as you would any other.
And ask me.
Absolutely.
And just order me around. Good for him.
He held out for it. He held out. It's the proudest moment that I've had researching James. And Jefferson never could write that letter. He instead wrote a white French chef who had not been in France for 15 years and knew nothing about all of the new additions to the food and et cetera. Didn't know anything about French fries. Didn't know anything about firm ice cream. Didn't know anything about meringues. All of that macaroni and cheese. Didn't know anything about it. But James had the last laugh because as a condition to his freedom. He made a contract with Jefferson that he would teach his brother Peter everything that he had learned in France.
Right.
And in an 8x10 room, if you even whisper, everybody hears it. If you sneeze, everybody hears it.
Right.
And if you're cooking, everybody in the kitchen knows what you're doing step by step.
Right.
And two of James's cousins, Edith Fawcett and Hearns, were in the kitchen, and those are the two women that Jefferson took to the White House to teach the white chef James's preferred style of cooking, which was half Virginian and half fine French, something he invented, a fusion that he invented while he was in Paris. So there's a whole bunch of this story that needs to come to moving pictures because that is our goal, and we really need people to go to the JamesHemingsSociety.org and join our mailing list, and if you can give us some, you know, financial support, because we've just introduced in Brownsville, Brooklyn, at the Trey Whitfield School, we did a 3-day course in Black culinary history, and we created a Black culinary history curriculum for organizations and schools.
Oh, wow, that's outstanding.
So that we actually hit the problem with about, you know, just not knowing about these incredible figures in our culinary history. We actually put ourselves in a position to actually teach this as a curriculum to cooking schools and grammar schools, and the kids absolutely loved it. And it was a 3-day session, and they got so much from it, and it literally just warmed my heart, because it was something that was so much needed, and they literally lapped it up. And so we're looking to do all kinds of initiatives, like our Chefs Abroad program, so that we could actually help young African-American chefs take a 2 to 3 month stage abroad to study cooking like James did, and bring that back to their flavors in America and their lives as young cooks in America. So we're looking to have some help to raise the funds for that for those endeavors, because it's missing in the marketplace. There are a lot of young Black and Hispanic women that are going to culinary school, but very few make it to executive chef status.
Wow.
And very few have the funds from their families to travel abroad, to go to France, to go to India, to go to South America. And we don't have family wealth like that. And so the James Henry Society is endeavoring to be that
resource.
That literally, yes, you're right. That resource that informs and leads. Because that's what chefs are, leaders of the kitchen. And so, you know, and I take it very seriously because I grew up in the segregated South.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, I just think that, you know, everything that you're endeavoring to do is just so needed, because this history is our history, and it's important for us to see ourselves in history. Yeah. To know what's possible. And that was very powerful for James Hemings to stand up for himself and request Thomas Jefferson write a letter. I'm still shocked to hear that Thomas Jefferson took multiple slaves with him and lied to the French about it.
It was just Sally and James, but the fact is that he lied to the French government. And the papa was to take legal advice as to what should he do.
Right.
Yeah, and that is definitely very, very telling of Jefferson's character, because he was quite happy to be the poster boy for the Enlightenment, and he had more empathy for the French peasants who were in a similar condition to the enslaved Africans in America.
Right.
But he had much more sympathy for them because the hue was different.
Right.
Yeah.
The hypocrisy is overwhelming. So before we end the interview, I want to know a little bit more about the genesis of Asheville. And how can I get my hands on some turkey pastrami?
Okay. You brought up Gordon Ramsay, in London is where I created the turkey pastrami, and also a lamb pastrami.
You said and lamb?
A lamb pastrami.
Can you get that on ashbells.com, the lamb pastrami?
No, you can't yet.
Oh, okay. That's in the works. Okay.
You will be able to get that soon. Okay. I created those two products, and I started to sell them at high-end places in London.
Mm-hmm.
And with the lamb, I immediately sold it to the big Muslim deli on Edgware Road.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the turkey pastrami and the lamb pastrami was sold in Chiswick. In the delis in Chiswick, which literally got something very cheap like turkey, and they literally sold it because cured meats are sold at a very different price in the UK, and it was my product was sold for the equivalent of $135 for 2 pounds. And I literally started there, and Gordon Ramsay's restaurant was the first restaurant that both the turkey pastrami and the lamb pastrami was admitted on their cutting board. So I'm very proud of the fact that I actually had my turkey pastrami and lamb pastrami in his restaurant. So
Gordon, you had your products in Gordon Ramsay's restaurant at one point.
Yeah, at one point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because there was nothing like it in London. Nobody had ever cured lamb in England like I did and made it halal. So I had a lot of Muslim friends that who would say, we need some of that lamb. And we're bringing you the halal meat. We don't trust anybody to buy the meat but us. And we bring it to you, and you do your thing. And I'm very happy about that. And so lamb pastrami is coming on the Ashbells line. So when I got back to America, I had to find an income. This is the Ashbell story. I got back in 2014. And I applied for Social Security, thinking that, oh, I'll apply early and that'll be some income till I figure out what to do. Well, because I'd been out of the country for 25 years, you know, off and on, that I didn't have much work history in the state. So the Social Security was minimal. So I took that. And started smoking salmon on a friend's back porch in Philadelphia, and I sold it at the farmer's market in Rittenhouse Square, which is the richest part of Philadelphia, for $50 a pound. And I consistently sold out of the lamb, of the turkey pastrami, and salmon, and that's how. The whole Ashbells company was born out of meager Social Security income and a big run in farmers markets. It's a great place to test out products, et cetera. And we ended up doing farmers markets in New York, upstate New York, New York City, Manhattan and Brooklyn, and the whole Philadelphia region. And then we transitioned to selling online just this past year. So I'm very happy to say that we're the only food site in America that even produces jerk chicken. And so jerk chicken is available at ashbells.com, and it's jerk chicken with the proper heat on it. We spare
with the proper heat?
Yep. we spare no Scotch bonnet peppers. And so I one moment said, oh, well, this is hot. And I said, yes, but it was an elderly woman that had come up to the stand in Philadelphia, in Rittenhouse Square. She was walking with her walker, and she went to taste the jerk chicken. I said, well, that's very spicy. And I just want to warn you, it's very spicy. So she looked at me, she popped it in her mouth, and she started weaving in the walker. And I said, are you okay? She said, young man, I'm fine. Wrap me two of these packages up. I've been going to Jamaica since you had to take a boat. Don't tell me about jerk chicken. And she bought two big packs of it. I thought, yeah, you never know about food. And that's why I really kind of created these global flavors by focusing on average person's mouths. So I didn't do it as a black product. I did it as a set of global products using, 10 different spices on the pastrami, on the turkey pastrami, and authentic a jerk paste on the jerk chicken and jerk salmon. I'm very proud of that because you get some authenticity, and that is that's what I'm bringing to really find food on the internet. And literally right now we have, a great special going on where 10% off and free shipping. So it is definitely a safe choice to have our products delivered to your door and provide you some extra flavor in the next several months of this.
Social distancing and sheltering in place.
yeah, absolutely. So we will safely send products to your door. And
that's awesome.
So definitely try out ashbells.com and 10% off and free shipping. So we're definitely looking for your mouth to be a dedicated customer.
That's outstanding. That's awesome. Well, Chef Ashbell, I'm just so grateful for you coming on to the show and sharing just all the rich history, American history, African-American history, culinary history with us. And I definitely want to encourage my listeners to go to ashbells.com, order your turkey pastrami, and then also go to jameshemmingssociety.org and learn much more about James Hemmings and keep posted on the upcoming documentary, The Ghost in America's Kitchen. So, Chef Ashbell, thank you so much for coming on to my show, and until next time.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope this is not the last time I'm going to be on.
No, it won't be. It will not be.
Thank you so much. I totally enjoyed it.
Likewise.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. On demand, powerful talk radio. We global, and you can't do nothing about it. BashaniRadio.com. Always talking about everything. Keep it locked.